All right, guys, you are locked on Falcons. I'm your host, Aaron Freeman. In today's episode, we are recapping the first Falcons foray into free agency by offering one of their cornerbacks a one-year extension. We'll be talking more about their cornerback depth. We'll be talking more about all the trades going on around the NFL and maybe how the Falcons could or should get into the mix and much, much more on today's episode.
You are locked on Falcons. Your daily podcast on the Atlanta Falcons, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
So guys, you know me, I'm Aaron Freeman, founder of FalcFans.com, one of the longest running Falcon fan sites on the internet, and also the host of this podcast. If you want to find me tweeting about various topics, how I rank Marvel Netflix TV shows, you can find me on Twitter at FalcFans, and you can also find the show at Locked On Falcons on Twitter. So what are we talking about on today's show? We are talking about Bleedy Ray Wilson, what that does to the cornerback depth. We'll talk a little bit more in depth about cornerbacks in general and maybe some trades and sort of what we're talking about, where all these teams are making trades, looking at you, Cleveland Browns, and why some people are looking at why aren't the Falcons making these moves and some of the things, reasons why they aren't. And maybe some of the reasons why they might, if they so choose to do so. So let's get started. So the Falcons gave Bleedy Ray a one-year contract extension. Basically, we don't know the terms of it, but the guess is they gave him a one-year minimum contract before. You know, technically it's an extension because his contract technically hasn't expired. It doesn't expire until March 14th. I'm using air quotes for in an audio format, but so it's technically a one-year extension. It's basically a one-year contract. I'm assuming at this point, I would be highly surprised if it's worth more than veteran minimum. Maybe there's a very small signing bonus under $30,000 that may, you know, boost his contract, but more than likely he's only going to count less than $650,000 against the Falcons cap due to the minimum salary cap benefit. We know what Bleedy Ray Wilson can do. He stepped up in that Vikings game when Trufant and Poole were out. He's basically going to be the team's de facto fifth corner. They'll probably bring in a guy or two between now and the draft and undrafted free agency that could potentially push him for that job. But I think right now, you look at the Falcons' holes at their cornerback position. With the news that KZ is going to get some more work at nickel cornerback, he may push Brian Poole for that third cornerback spot. With Bleedy Ray Wilson, because he can play special teams, he's a functional special teams player. He proved that he was a functional fourth corner last year for a game. I think the Falcons are probably going to invest a draft pick somewhere between rounds 3 and 5 to upgrade their cornerback depth, get a young guy that can be a little bit more of a man cover guy that can offer a little bit more size than either Poole. You know, you want a guy that's bigger than Poole, but you want a guy that does a little bit more in man coverage than Bleedy Ray Wilson does, ideally. And so I think the Falcons will probably target that player somewhere at the end of day two or early on day three in the draft. So, you know, that's basically all I really have to say about the Bleedy Ray Wilson move. I don't think, you know, this is a solid move for the Falcons to build their depth. And I think these are going to be the types of moves that you're going to expect to see from this team over the next week or so as free agency kicks off in a couple of days officially as of today. You listening to this podcast, the unofficial tampering period has begun and will continue for the next 48 hours, I guess, until Wednesday when things officially kick off at 4 p.m. Eastern, deals that are agreed upon over the next couple of days are become official, and we'll see a lot more moves happen. Now let's talk about trades. There's been a lot of trades, and there's been several trades of cornerbacks the last couple of days. We saw Demaryius Randall get traded from the Packers to the Browns. We saw Marcus Peters get traded from the Chiefs to the Rams. We saw earlier this offseason the Redskins trade Kendall Fuller to the Chiefs. Denver is now traded Aqib Talib to the Rams as well. I'm sure there's another cornerback trade that I'm forgetting. Richard Sherman got cut after he was shopped and now has signed with the 49ers. So given that we're talking about cornerbacks a little bit more in depth and building up the Falcons' cornerback depth, some of these trades do make sense. And I think a lot of people sort of look at all these other trades, these bold moves that other teams are making, like, why not the Falcons? Now, in the case of a guy like Marcus Peters, it didn't make a lot of sense for the Falcons, even though he's a massive upgrade for what the Falcons could possibly do. The issue with Peters is essentially, I'm going to use air quotes again, let's say he's, shall we say, a high-maintenance player, as we saw this past season. And truth be told, probably Peters didn't want to play anywhere outside of the West Coast, if we're being honest. And the problem with Peters is money-wise. You know, the Rams are going to have to decide between now and, I think, May 2nd is the deadline or whenever it is around that time, to exercise the fifth-year option on Peters to keep him under contract through 2019 because he's a former first-round pick. And from what I understand, that fifth-year option is going to count about $10 million. So if you're going to trade for him at this point and give up value for him, the assumption is you will exercise that option. And the Rams have the ability to do that because they don't have two other highly paid cornerbacks. The Falcons do with Alford and Trufant. And with $10 million, in addition to the $23 million that Alford and Trufant are going to count against the Falcons cap in 2019, ostensibly 1/6 of the Falcons cap would be dedicated in 2019 to their top three corners, which is not something that's financially responsible, as we might say. And, you know, I know there are some people that think, oh, well, if that was going to be the case, it's not necessarily Peters that would be the problem. It would be Alford and Trufant, one of those or both of those guys in some people's eyes, that the Falcons shouldn't necessarily commit that type of money to. But we'll circle back to sort of talking about Alford and Trufant a little bit later in the episode. And before we move on and talk more trades, the thing about trades is that they often involve draft picks. And if you want to talk draft picks, there's no better place than Locked On NFL Draft with hosts John Ledyard and Trevor Sikkema, who will be bringing you the latest on all the next week's free agent moves and how that's going to impact where these teams are headed going into the draft. So definitely check out that podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, wherever podcasts can be found, including now Spotify. So let's keep the trade talk going. Let's talk about the Tlaib trade and one of the reasons why the Falcons couldn't necessarily be in on the Aqib Tlaib trade. If you're saying Aqib Tlaib would have been a great fit in Atlanta, given how much they value man coverage, good man corners, you're absolutely right. But the problem was they just couldn't afford a guy like Aqib Tlaib. That would have required them taking on an $11 million cap hit this year. And as we suggested on Friday's episode this past week, if you didn't listen to, I think the Falcons really only have about $9.5 million to spend in free agency once they lock up their restricted free agents. They have about, without knowing the terms of what Brooks Reed's restructure is like, what the exact terms of Matt Bryant's contract is like, and now what Bleedy Ray Wilson's contract is like, you're talking about, you know, probably around 16 or so million in cap space for the Falcons before all those other moves I just named. But then after the restricted free agents like Ricardo Allen and Ben Garland and Teron Ward and Sherrod Neesman and possibly Nick Williams get their tender offers, you're only talking about like $9.5 million to really spend on free agents, which is primarily going to be spent. That's one of the reasons why the team is targeting guys like Bleedy Ray Wilson, who you presumably can get on 1 year veteran minimum contracts. You can sign a half dozen guys like that and not spend very much money. But the issue, again, going back to the Tlaib, reason why we didn't make a play for Tlaib is just the $11 million cap hit was just too much. He just couldn't afford it. Again, 11 is more than 9.5. And so, you know, if the Falcons really wanted to make room for Tlaib, in addition to being able to make all the other additional moves that they potentially need to make this offseason, there's really only two ways that they could have done that, and that would have been cut into one of two players. One of those players would have been Matt Ryan, which we knew they weren't going to happen. The other one would have been Jake Matthews, which we also know didn't happen. I know there's some people out there grumbling, thinking, well, they should have cut Jake Matthews, but, you know, anybody with half a brain knows that you don't swap a 26-year-old above-average left tackle for a 32-year-old declining third cornerback. At least you shouldn't. That's just not a whole lot of logical sense to make. And, you know, if the Falcons did do that in some hypothetical world, that would pretty much mean that they would be guaranteed to have to use their number one pick on a left tackle this offseason in the draft. And there really aren't any left tackle prospects that are better prospects than Jake Matthews. And when I say that, I don't necessarily mean that that means that those guys won't eventually become better players than Jake Matthews. But even if they do, you're probably talking about a situation 2 to 3 years from now. And then by that point, Talib is going to be gone. And so is it really worth it just to get 2 years of Aqib Talib and probably 2+ years of below average offensive tackle play? Then you have Richard Sherman. And like Talib, he would have had to absorb his $11 million cap hit to make the trade. And he's also a 30-year-old guy, soon to be 30 years old. And he's coming off an Achilles injury. That's an 18-month injury, meaning that typically from the time a guy gets hurt, it takes about 18 months before he's fully, you know, he's close to being back to what he was pre-injury. So it takes a season and a half, really, to recover from that. And there are exceptions, but given his age and given the fact that the human body does not recover as well at age 30 as it does at age, say, 25, and, you know, that's kind of universal, Sherman wasn't likely to be one of those guys, one of the exceptions, I mean. And really, Sherman's not really the ideal sort of man corner that you're looking for, particularly given the injury issue. Like, he's probably better than Brian Poole or Bleedy Ray Wilson is to cover the Mike Thomases and the Mike Evanses of the world. But I don't necessarily feel like, oh, yeah, now that we got Richard Sherman, we're going to definitely shut down those guys. Like, I just think he's going to, those guys are going to beat him either more than they already beat Alford and Trufant. So, you know, if you're going to live in this hypothetical world to suggest that the Falcons need to be a little bit more active and more aggressive in making a bold splash, in particular for trading for a corner, you know, I think if you're going to live in that world, the argument you're going to make is maybe for a guy like a Ronald Darby, who's reportedly might be on the block for the Eagles, who traded for him last summer in the who did they trade? Jordan Matthews, they traded him to Buffalo. And, you know, Darby is a promising young guy on a rookie contract that shows man cover skills that you would probably want. And the Falcons would only have to really absorb $1 million in terms of cap penalties this year to trade for him. And so you don't really have to commit to him beyond 2018. So you don't necessarily have to make that trade with the notion like you would with Peters and be like, oh yeah, we have to commit to him for 2019. If he works out this year, then you could pay him, you know, or if he doesn't, then you can let him walk and get a comp pick in 2020. Who knows? The one knock on a guy like Darby is the durability concerns. He's been dealing with that the last couple of years. He's been a little bit up and down because of that, which, you know, isn't a huge, huge issue because you can argue that Trufant and Alford also are up and down like pretty much all NFL corners are up and down to a certain extent. But yeah, like if the Falcons were going to make a trade for a corner, it would make more sense to go after a guy like Darby because he fits the scheme. He doesn't require you to have to make a long-term commitment. He doesn't require you to have to make a substantial short-term commitment. You're basically paying slightly, you know, maybe like $300,000 more than you would have to pay for a guy like Bleedy Ray Wilson. And so that makes a lot of sense. And those are the types of trades, trading for guys on rookie contracts, guys that are entering year two, generally speaking, teams don't trade guys after 1 year, but guys that are entering year three or year four on their rookie contracts, those would be the types of trades that you would sort of look for the Falcons to potentially make. I don't think they're going to make those trades, but if we're, again, we're playing the game of talking trades, if they're going to pull the trigger on any of these trades that other teams are making, those would be the types of trades that we're talking about. So a trade like the Demarius Randle, but for a better player than Demarius Randle. You know, if you want to shop like conditional late round picks for some of these guys, which, you know, particularly, you know, you look at a team like the Browns, who seem to be having a fire sale under new GM John Dorsey for some of the old Sashi Brown picks over the last couple of years. And maybe they would be willing to unload some of these underachievers like they've been. You know, guys like Kaiser, guys like Danny Shelton. You know, you look at that defense and you say, oh, look, you know, Nate Orchard was a third round pick for them 3 years ago. He could sort of be developed into a long term Brooks Reed replacement as like a third defensive end in the rotation. He's not really a great run defender. He's not necessarily a great pass rusher, but he's competent at both. to sort of be in the mix and give you some decent depth out of a young guy long term. You look at a tight end like Randall Telfair, who I think was a fifth round pick in that 2015 draft for the Browns. He played under Sark at USC. He's been a decent blocking tight end, could be a functional number two guy that wouldn't require you to have to commit significant dollars at that position in free agency. A more bigger name guy would be a guy like Emmanuel Ogba, who was a really outstanding run-defending defensive end for you, and certainly would be a good fit as a Derek Shelby replacement for the Falcons in the base defense, and offers certainly much more pass-rushing upside than a guy like Shelby did. You could say the same thing about Carl Nassib, who was, I think, also in that 2016 draft for the Browns. He can also do a little bit kicking inside. Maybe you kick the tires on some of the Browns' wide receivers. Ricardo Lewis was a late-round pick a couple of years ago. He could be sort of a field stretcher potentially that could replace Taylor Gabriel as your fourth wide receiver. If you want to go much more splashier, maybe you give a phone call about Corey Coleman or Josh Gordon, who, given that the Browns just traded for Jarvis Landry, I don't imagine that they'll want to keep both Corey Coleman and Josh Gordon. You know, that would be a very good trio of wide receivers, but it does seem like, I don't know if you can keep all three of those guys happy, especially with a guy like Landry. Gordon probably has a higher upside. Corey Coleman's been dealing with injuries the last couple of years. But, you know, if you could get one of those guys for like a fifth or sixth round pick, I don't know why you wouldn't make that trade. I'd certainly bet on one of those guys for a fifth or sixth round pick, as opposed to using, you know, a third or fourth round pick in the draft for someone who's not nearly as talented as either one of those guys. And, like, I don't say all that with this attitude of, oh, man, the Falcons need to do this. You know, like, the Falcons do whatever they want to do. I just sit here and judge them for it. But, like, these are the types of moves that if you're sitting there and being like, man, why aren't the Falcons making moves? It's like, these are the more plausible moves that the Falcons could make, because it doesn't require a significant investment of draft capital, potentially, and it doesn't require a significant investment of their cap space, because you're getting guys on rookie contracts, and generally guys on rookie deals, unless they're first-round picks, count less than $1 million a year. And that's basically the equivalent of signing a guy to a veteran minimum contract. Basically, for me, I've made peace with the fact, or at least with my expectations, that the Falcons are going to be pretty passive and low-key this offseason in terms of trying to upgrade the roster in major ways. As I explained on Friday, I think the Bennett trade was probably – the Michael Bennett trade was the one potential quote-unquote splash move that they could have made, that I was at least optimistic that the team could make to try to upgrade one of the key areas of their roster. That I think, you know, as I will explain later, I think the Falcons should be a little bit aggressive at trying to upgrade those, but those are parts of the roster that they can wait until the draft and be okay doing that. That brings me back to where I wanted to circle back to with Trufant and Alford, and somewhat of the perception within our fan base that those guys are somehow bad. And I do want to throw out some stats that earlier today, when I was getting into an argument with someone on Twitter about our cornerback play, I was just looking up some stats just to throw it in that person's face, as I often do. And I came across these stats and I was like, oh, this is interesting. And so I'll share this with you guys. But before I do, I want to also remind you guys that Locked On NFL with host Matt Williamson is counting down the top players at each position group that are hitting free agency. So if you want to find out about all the guys that the Falcons won't sign, maybe you can check out that show, but maybe the Falcons will get a couple of those guys off that list. So go check out Locked On NFL podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, wherever podcasts can be found. So let's talk cornerbacks. Let's talk some in-depth stats that I found interesting. Maybe you guys will find interesting. I don't get the Trufant. Before we get to that, I don't get the Trufant Alford backlash. I mean, I get it, because I think people have a tendency to overreact to certain things. And I've gone on rants about this before, about people being way too emotional on Sunday, or not necessarily being way too emotional on Sunday. You can be as emotional as you want watching the games live. I just think you got to kind of have to let that stuff go when Monday rolls around, but I don't think enough people do. And I think this is why you get bad takes like, oh, Trufant is bad or Alford is bad, just because, you know, they got burnt a couple of times last season, and it's like that kind of happens to cornerbacks. Like, you just don't have that foundation. And then I guess this is some of those times when I get a little bit arrogant or a little bit condescending in some of my opinions about other people's opinions, is because I think people tend to overreact on Sunday and then don't ever have the wherewithal to go back and say, oh, let me ground my sort of subjective take in some objective truth. And that's where I think stats can come into this thing and help you out. You know, like, that's what I try to do. I try not to form strong opinions about things based off of subjective perspective. I try to, like, have, like, obviously, as you guys know, I do have opinions, don't get me wrong, but I try to, like, it's a soft opinion until I can later go back, and particularly at the end of the season, go back and look at some of the numbers and be like, oh, is this opinion backed up? Is there statistical evidence to support this opinion I had? And if there is, I'm like, okay, then I can sort of solidify, I can submit that opinion a little bit more firmly. If it doesn't, then I'm like, okay, you know, that's a subjective opinion, but, you know, that's more something that maybe isn't necessarily true. And my own thoughts and biases on these sorts of things can sort of lead me astray on some of these things. So that's how I sort of view things. And I wish there were more people that thought that way, but I do think there's a tendency for people to think their own sort of subjectivity is absolute truth. And sort of, you know, there's been plenty of studies out there that say when people have opinions and then you present them with compelling evidence that suggests that their opinion is wrong, it tends to make them less willing to change their opinion. They, in fact, go the opposite way and become even further entrenched in their sort of previously wrong, quote unquote, wrong opinion. So we see that all the time. But let's get into the stats that I discovered today. And, you know, I found an interesting stat, particularly when it comes to Alford and Trufant, because you hear a constant criticism of either one of those guys or both of those guys that they give up a ton of big plays and they're constantly getting burnt. And, you know, you look at the number of big plays that the Falcons defense gave up in 2017, and they didn't give up that many relative to most teams in the league. Looking at the 20-plus yard pass plays allowed in 2017 and adjusted for the number of pass attempts thrown, the Falcons were the 8th best defense in the league at preventing those big plays from being given up. Only about 7.8% of their pass attempts went for 20 or more yards last year. Pass attempts against them went for 20 or more yards. And longtime listeners of this podcast know what I think about 20-plus yard plays, particularly through the air. But if you're new to the show, basically the short version of that is that those big plays correlate highly with, you know, your ability to score points. And the quote-unquote logic behind that, and again, I use air quotes to say logic, is because one of the things I plan on doing probably after the draft is do a lot more extensive research on this phenomenon as a league-wide whole. And maybe it's not necessary 20-plus yard plays. Maybe it's 15-yard plays. Maybe it's 17-yard plays. Maybe it's 25-yard plays. And that's something I do want to discover, you know, dig deeper on this offseason. But that'll probably wait until May and June when things tend to die down. But basically, when you get these big plays, the logic behind why that is very valuable is because converting third downs in this league is really hard. And basically, you can argue that for every 20-plus yard play you get, that's one less third down that you as an offense has to convert on a scoring drive. And it's much easier to move the ball down the field when you don't have to convert a bunch of third downs versus, you know, if you only have to convert 2 third downs on a drive, it's easier to score on that drive than if you had to convert 3 third downs. So that's sort of the logic behind that. For those of you that are new to this concept of explosiveness that I constantly talk about on this podcast, you will hear much, much more about that over the next months and years that I continue to do this. If you decide to stick around, which you should. So you can see this correlation reflected because if you look at the top 10 teams in terms of the amount of points allowed in 2017, six of those top 10 teams, you know, six of the top 10 scoring defenses in the league were also in the top 10 in allowing the least amount of 20-plus yard plays through the air this past season. And the opposite is true when you look at the bottom 10 teams in terms of giving up the teams that gave up the most points this past year. Seven of those bottom 10 in points allowed were also bottom 10 in allowing 20-plus yard plays. And the 11th worst defense in scoring defense was also in the bottom 10. So it's one of those things where it's like, generally speaking, if you're good at preventing teams from getting big plays in the air, you're generally not going to give up as much points as teams that aren't good at that. So again, that is reflective of that correlation that I just talked about. And so the point of me telling you that stat really is, I do think people tend to exaggerate how much of an issue, you know, how often Trufant and Alford are getting burnt is. You know, I've said this a million times, and I've said it already on this podcast, but sort of the nature of the cornerback position is to give up plays. You know, like, it's inevitable. It's just teams are going to throw the ball 35-plus times a game. Occasionally, you know, one of those is going to be a 23-yard gain. One of those is going to be a 27-yard gain. Occasionally, there's going to be a 40-yard gain mixed in there. But certainly as a team, you know, the Falcons are only giving up these plays on an occasional basis. Some teams are giving them up on a constant basis, but the Falcons are as an occasional basis. And if I look at the Pro Football Focus data correctly, I would say it looks like, you know, not, I don't have the exact number in front of me, but it looks like Trufant and Alford are only responsible for about 15 or 16 of the big plays out of the 43 that the Falcons gave up through the air last year collectively. So roughly a third of the plays, which, you know, amounts to be about one per game, which, you know, obviously, if they could lower that threshold, that would be ideal. But, you know, one big play through the air between our top two corners who spend so much time, you know, manning up these other wide receivers is actually pretty good to me. You know, over the course of 160-plus targets that they're getting over the regular season, if a tenth of those plays are big plays, that's an acceptable number to me personally. You know, you look at Julio Jones and, like, I think it's like 20% of his targets are big plays. So it's not like they're giving up a massive amount of big plays. You know, they're not giving up a Julio Jones equivalent or an Antonio Brown equivalent on their on defense. Another fun stat I looked at today, I looked at the Falcons' third down defense, particularly on when they're defending the pass, because we're talking about cornerbacks. I wasn't focused really on the run. So these other stats I'm going to quote to you are more focused on, or just using pass plays. And sort of separating third and short versus third and long. And we talk about this with the offense, where the Falcons are really good at converting third and shorts on offense, but not so good at converting third and longs, which I think is a knock on Sark's play calling, but that's something I'll save for another day. We can talk about that. Let's talk about the defense. And I think, you know, a really good way of telling who's got a really stingy third down defense is who's really stingy on third and shorts. And when I mean, say third and shorts, I mean 6 yards or less to go, and third and long is 7 yards or more to go. And, you know, basically third and shorts are league-wide roughly 50-50 proposition for the offense of converting, as league-wide about 47% of third and shorts were converted by teams through the air last year. And the Falcons, as a defense, were slightly below average, ranking 19th, by allowing 47.8% of their third and shorts through the air to be converted to first downs on, just count factoring the passing plays. So that's certainly an area where the Falcons can improve upon in 2018 as they try to make their way to be recognized as one of the best defenses in the league this upcoming season. Minnesota, as many of you know, was the best in the league in sort of preventing third and shorts being converted, with only giving up 32% on these pass plays on third and short. Denver was ranked second with only allowing 39%. Houston was third with 41%. The Eagles were seventh, allowing 43%. Jacksonville, another top defense, was 12th, allowing 45%, and several teams in between. But in looking at these numbers, I was like, oh, I thought the Falcons would be better. But one of the things that was interesting to me was another stat popped out to me, And it was really how poor the Falcons' pass rush was in these third and short situations. The Falcons were, in fact, the second worst team in the NFL in generating sacks on these third and short situations. They only had two all of last year. Only the Jets were worse than them with one, and that's even when you adjust for the amount of pass attempts. The league average was about six sacks in these third and short situations. The league high was nine, and there were six teams that were tied for that lead, including the Broncos and Jaguars. And it's not to sit here and be like, just because you get a lot of sacks in third and short means that you're going to have a great third down success rate. Like, Green Bay had nine sacks. They were tied for the league lead with nine sacks, and they were the second worst in terms of preventing first downs or third and shorts in the passing game. Tampa Bay was the worst on these third and short defenses, and they had seven sacks. But you could certainly argue that if the Falcons were able to create better pressure and create sacks and get some of these stops, that they would certainly enhance their ability in this particular metric. For example, if the Falcons had just gotten the league average of six sacks, that would have resulted in four less first downs converted on these third and shorts. And, you know, their ranking would have jumped from 18th to 7th based off of last year's stats. So, you know, four more sacks, four more stops isn't going to necessarily change the entire scope of the season. So I don't want anybody to be like, oh, this is, you know, this is not, it's not a huge, huge deal. But it is one of those things where it's like, you know, this is one more piece of evidence, I think, that suggests that where the Falcons' primary focus needs to be on, and that's really up front this offseason, at least relative to sort of focusing on the back end of their defense, where I think the Falcons are mostly good. I think they can certainly use the upgrades there. I'm not going to begrudge them if they upgrade the cornerback position, as we discussed earlier. They certainly need to address their linebacker depth. But it's one of those positions where, you know, the Falcons really need, like, if the Falcons, unless the Falcons are drafting another sort of, you know, a guy that they feel is can check Michael Thomas man-to-man, I don't think they should use a high pick on defense unless it's a guy that can help their pass rush. That's basically my conclusion. And this evidence and this stats sort of are just further evidence that I would use to argue that opinion. And that's it. That's all I wanted to talk about today. We'll be back soon to talk more about free agency and some of these rumors. As I've said a number of times, I do think this opening salvo of free agency is going to be a relatively quiet period for the Falcons. So, you know, I think they will make a move or two, but I don't think it's going to be the big splash. I think it's going to be more like some of these moves, like Bleedy Ray Wilson, more so than, you know, signing an Alex Mack or a Mohamed Sanu type of guy that's big, big name, big news type of big time signing. We've heard some rumors over the last couple of days that the Falcons are interested in some free agent tight ends. I don't really quite get that. You know, it seems like their response to overpaying a number two tight end last offseason seems to be to, based off of these rumors, to overpay another number two tight end. So that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. I know there are plenty of people that think Hooper is truly a number two tight end than a number one. I don't quite agree with that, but, you know, and I it doesn't make sense for me from the team to basically come to that conclusion at this point in time, given how young Hooper is. But if the Falcons came to that conclusion, it certainly would make sense to me if they targeted a guy in the draft to you know, push and replace Hooper as their, you know, tight end of the future. But signing a guy in free agency for what ostensibly is a middling to slightly above average tight end just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. But, you know, these are rumors. I'm not putting a whole lot of stock in them, but who knows? We'll see what happens. And if something happens with the Falcons, if something happens between now and Tuesday evening, I will be back on Wednesday to give you my rapid reaction to whatever's going on with the Falcons as free agency opens officially. If something doesn't happen, then I'll probably just wait till Wednesday evening to record whatever's going on, whatever rumors, and we'll get, you know, typically the Falcons have signed somebody on the opening day of free agency, whether that was Reed and Durant in 2015, whether that was Mack, I think Sanu in 2016. I think they were opening day moves. And who was it last year? Jack Crawford. So typically the Falcons do sign somebody. So I do think we'll get some news on Wednesday. But like I said, there's a decent chance that it is more Blee, Ray, Wilson type of signings. But yeah, I'll be back either Wednesday or Thursday with, you know, some thoughts on what's going on with the Falcons. If there's any news or report, we'll give you that rapid reaction. But we'll see what happens. And until then, if you guys want to give me your feedback, you can do so, of course, on Twitter. I am at FalcFans. If it's podcast related, just let me know in the tweet. But if it is podcast related, just go ahead and send it over to the show's Twitter handle. That's Locked On Falcons. Locked On Falcons is also the name of the Facebook page if you prefer that social media platform. If you want to send an email where there are no character limits, by all means, you can do so at lockedonfalcons@mail.com. Lockedonfalcons.com and falcfans.com is where the show is posted daily. You can leave a comment on either one of those two websites. I know I've been promising giving you those leftover mailbags. On LockedOnFalcons.com. I promise you I will work on it this week. I will not let another week go by without posting something that is a leftover mailbag. I've been promising that for pretty much a month now, and that's what I do. I just procrastinate on stuff. But we won't go another week without me working on that. So until then, guys, stay tuned to LockedOnFalcons.com, LockedOnFalcons on Twitter, FalcFans on Twitter, and we will be back with more Locked On Falcons content. You guys stay locked on. And let me say locked on four more times before we wrap this thing. Locked on, locked on, locked on, locked on.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team every day.
So guys, you know who me. You know who me. You know. So guys, you know me. So guys. Okay, all right, hold on.